8. April 21st, 1967. Dear Francis Grace, I can hardly believe you've been there for more than a month. In your absence, the country has gone mad. Sit-ins, protests, raised fists. Believe you me, more than a few of these free love girls are going to wake up in trouble, and where will their dirty-footed lovers be then? In prison or long gone, I'd say. The world changes for men, Francis. For women, it stays pretty much the same. The president says the protests are prolonging the war. Your father and I watch the news every night, hoping for a glimpse of you, however silly that is. The soldiers seem to be in good spirits. With love, your mother. P.S. I saw an old friend of yours, I can't recall her name, the frizzy-haired girl from St. Bernadette's that played volleyball so poorly. Anyway, I saw her in a televised picket line in San Francisco. Her breasts were moving so fast they looked like Sonny Liston's boxing gloves doing battle under a dirty T-shirt. Can someone please explain to me how bouncing breasts advance the cause of freedom? As her shift neared its end and night began to fall, Frankie sat in a chair beside one of her patients, a young man from Oklahoma. She'd been promoted to the day shift 2 weeks ago. She closed the book from which she'd been reading aloud, Sometimes a Great Notion. "Well, Trevor," she said to her patient, "I'm beat. Gotta hit the showers and mess and then bed. It was so dang hot today that the water might be lukewarm." She touched his hand. "You're heading out to the third tomorrow. I'll miss you." She gave his hand a squeeze and then went from bed to bed, saying goodnight to each of her patients with a touch and a whispered, "You're safe now. We will get you home." It was all she could think of to say to men so broken. Then she grabbed her warm can of tab and headed for her hooch. It was a hot, dry day in May. The blistering sun had baked the dirt to hard pan and dried out her skin and hair. She was constantly scratching and sweating. In the hooch, she found Ethel and Barb dressed in civilian clothes, Ethel in a summery dress she'd had made by a Vietnamese woman in Saigon, and Barb in a custom-made black silk Ao Yai. Frankie saw her dress laid out on her bed, the one she'd bought at Bullock's, a pretty blue sheath with a Peter Pan collar and matching belt. Something out of the last decade. Her mother had insisted she take it to war for parties. Frankie pushed the dress aside and plopped onto her bed. "I'm exhausted." Ethel looked at Barb.
"Are you tired?"
"Dead on my feet."
"Are you going to sleep or go to Captain Smith's goodbye party?"
"That's tonight," Frankie said, her shoulders slumping. "Darn."
"Move it, Frank," Ethel said.
There was no argument to be made. Captain Smith had been an amazing teacher and superior officer. He'd shown Frankie kindness and patience in teaching her the skills needed to care for the patients in neuro. She had spent countless hours with him in the ward, even shared a Coke with him a time or two in the O Club. She'd oohed and awed over pictures of his kids back in the world. No way she would miss a chance to say goodbye.
"That's our ride,"
Frankie said, frowning as they approached the helipad. Choppers might be big and maneuverable, but they were targets too. The enemy loved to shoot them out of the sky, and when a chopper exploded midair, there were often no remains to be found. She knew that too well. Hot air whooshed from the rotors, whipped up dirt, stung her eyes. Ethel shoved Frankie forward. A soldier swung her into the chopper. Frankie scrambled for the back, took a seat, and pressed herself against the wall. Barb and Ethel each sat in one of the open door frames, their feet swinging over the edge, laughing as the helicopter rose into the air and shot forward, nose down, tail up. The noise inside the chopper was ear-splitting. As they banked left, Frankie saw Vietnam through the open doorway, the flat green swath of jungle, a brown ribbon of water dotted with boats. White sand beaches bordered the turquoise waters of the South China Sea. Verdant mountains in the distance reached up into the blue, cloud-strewn sky. There was destruction, too. concertina wire that caught the light and sent it back in a thousand glints of color, giant red holes in the earth, trees fallen or cut down, scrap metal heaps strewn along roads, helicopters swooping across the landscape, firing at the ground, being fired on, the constant whir of their rotors, the pop-pop-pop of mortar attacks, tanks rolling on dirt roads, throwing up red clouds of dust. These days, the U.S. constantly bombed the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Up in the mountains, near a village called Pleiku, there was fighting.
"That's Long Bin," one of the gunners yelled.
Long Bin, Frankie knew, was one of the largest bases in country. Tens of thousands of people lived and worked there. She'd heard that the PX on base was bigger than any department store back home. From above, it was a sprawling city carved out of the jungle, built on a flat red rectangle of dirt. Bulldozers bit at the edges, constantly making more room. There wasn't a blade of grass or a tree to be seen, nothing green, no patch of shade left from the jungle they'd torn down to build their temporary city. They touched down on the helipad just as sunset turned the sky a brilliant, blazing red. Frankie angled cautiously forward, edged out of the chopper, and followed Ethel and Barb, who knew exactly where they were going in the dirty, smelly confusion of roads and people and tanks and bulldozers. The place was a hive of activity. A huge hospital was being built to house the rising number of wounded. The officers' club at Long Bin was legendary. Frankie had heard stories of epic parties and fall-down drunk fests, even of the MPs being called on occasion. Captain Smith, who'd been in Long Bin for most of his first tour, still spoke often of the club and said he wouldn't want a going-away party to be held anywhere else. Barb reached the O Club first and opened the door. Frankie moved in beside her. She felt conspicuous in her ridiculously conservative blue dress, with her nails bitten down to the quick and her black pixie cut grown so shaggy she looked like one of the Beatles. The headscarf she'd tied over it did little to help. At least she had sneakers now, instead of just her boots. The officers' club was not what she'd expected. But what had she expected? White linen tablecloths and waiters in black, like the country club on Coronado Island? In fact, it was just a dark, seedy bar. The stifling hot air smelled of cigarette smoke and spilled booze and sweat. A wooden bar ran the length of the building. A line of men were bellied up to it. More sat clustered around wooden tables in mismatched chairs. There weren't many women here, but the few that were here were on the dance floor. She saw Kathy Moore, one of the surgical nurses from the 36th, dancing with Captain Smith. A banner had been strung above the bar. It read, "Bon voyage, Captain Smith." Frankie was reminded suddenly of the catered party her parents had thrown to celebrate Finley going to war. It felt like another world ago, another time. Appallingly naive. Barb dragged Frankie through the clot of men, elbowing her way. At the bar, she ordered a gin and tonic and two sodas, yelling to be heard over the din of voices and music. A soldier stood beside her, smiling wolfishly, thrilled to see two American women. Frankie saw the big red one patch on his sleeve for the 1st Infantry. Barb ignored the man and carried the three drinks toward an empty table. The music changed, became sexy, a song Frankie hadn't heard before. "Come on, baby, light my fire." Frankie was about to make her way to the table when someone touched her arm. Dr. Jamie Callahan stood there, smiling. She remembered how he'd helped her through her first red alert, how steadying his voice had been, the kindness he'd shown her, and the night they'd talked by the latrines. She'd seen him once or twice in the mess hall or the O Club since she'd been promoted to days, but they'd not talked much. Tonight, in his white t-shirt and fatigues and combat boots, he was Robert Redford in This Property is Condemned good-looking. And he knew it. Dirty blonde hair, grown longer than regulation allowed, blue eyes, square jaw. Anyone would have called him the American boy next door, and yet there was sadness in his eyes, a slight sag to his shoulders. She sensed a despair in him that lay just below the surface. Grief.
Perhaps he saw it in her, too.
"It's a party now that the nurses have arrived,"
he said, giving her a strained smile. She met his gaze. The weeks she'd spent studying comatose patients had sharpened her observation skills. "Are you okay?" The music changed. Percy Sledge's soulful "When a Man Loves a Woman" filled the room.
"Dance with me, McGrath,"
he said. It wasn't a cocky, "I'm so cool and you'll be swept away" request. Not what she would have expected. That kind of thing she would have laughed at. This was a man's plea, tinged with desperation and loneliness. She knew that feeling well. She felt it during every shift as she moved among her comatose patients, hoping for miracles. She reached for his hand. He led her out onto the dance floor. She fit up against him, felt the solid strength of him, and realized suddenly, sharply, how lonely she was too. And not just here in Vietnam, but ever since Finley's death. She rested her cheek on his collarbone. They moved in an easy, familiar rhythm, changing their steps only when the music changed. Finally, she looked up, found him looking down at her. She reached up slowly, eased the hair out of his eyes.
"You look tired."
"Rough day."
He tried to smile, and the effort touched her. She knew how hard that particular camouflage could be.
"They're so young,"
he said.
"Tell me something good,"
she said. He thought for a minute, smiled.
"My 7-year-old niece, Kaylee, lost a tooth. The tooth fairy left her 50 cents and she bought a goldfish. Her brother Braden made the soccer team."
Frankie smiled at the sweetness of it. She was about to ask him something about his life back in the world when the door to the O Club burst open, letting in the sound of a distant mortar attack. A trio of men walked in. Strode, really. They were noticeable, loud, laughing. They didn't look military, let alone like officers. All three had hair that was too long to be regulation. Two had mustaches. One wore a cowboy hat and a warlock's t-shirt. Only one wore the blue fatigues of the Navy. They had their arms around each other's shoulders and were singing what sounded like a fight song. They pushed through the crowd and sat at a table that bore a reserved sign. One of them raised a hand, and a Vietnamese waitress wearing an Ao Yai rushed over with a bottle of Jack Daniels and 3 shot glasses on a tray. A smaller guy with reddish hair and a sparse mustache threw his head back and howled like a wolf.
"Who are they?"
Frankie asked. They looked more like Berkeley students or cowboys than naval officers.
"New squadron. The Sea Wolves. Naval Helicopter Combat Support. The Navy needed bird pilots, so last year they chose a few jet jockeys, asked for volunteers, and taught them to fly choppers. They may look arrogant and unchecked with their hair and clothing, but they're workhorses. They've flown a lot of medevacs for us in their off hours. You call on one of the Sea Wolves, and if they aren't fighting Victor Charlie, they show up."
He fell silent for a moment, then said,
"I've been thinking about you, McGrath."
Now he sounded and looked like any other on-the-make surgeon. This man she could laugh at.
"Really?"
"You've been hiding long enough."
"Hiding?"
"In neuro. Your girl squad, Ethel and Barb, tell me you're ready to move up."
"Oh."
"Captain Smith says you did exceptional work. Fastest learner he's ever had, he said."
Frankie didn't quite know how to respond. Captain Smith had never said that to her.
"He also says you are compassionate, which I already knew."
"Well?"
"The point is this. Did you come to this hellhole to change bandages or to save lives?"
"Well, I don't think that's quite fair, sir."
"Jamie," he said. "For God's sake, McGrath, Jamie."
"So, Jamie, I don't think that's quite fair. An opportunistic infection can—"
"Come work in surgery with me. Patty Perkins is a short-timer. I need someone good to replace her."
"I'm not good enough," she said. "Take Sarah from the burn unit."
"I want you, McGrath."
She heard more in that sentence than belonged there, enough heat to set off warning bells.
"If this is just a way to sleep with me,"
He gave her an easy smile.
Oh, I'd love to sleep with you, McGrath, but that's not what this is about.
I'm not good enough, honestly.
You will be when I get done with you. Scout's honor.
Were you ever a scout?
Hell no. I still can't figure out what I'm doing here. Too much debt and too many war stories, I think. My dad told me I was a fool, but here I am, and here I'll be for another 7 months. I need a kick-ass nurse at my side.
Frankie was afraid of all of it. Mass casualties, failing at her job, keeping Jamie at bay. But she'd been here almost 2 months, and as bad as it was, time was moving fast. She'd learned what she could from Neuro. If she really loved nursing and wanted to be even better, it was time to take the next step. Okay, Captain Callahan. I'll put in for a transfer to surgery.
Excellent.
He looked very pleased with himself. There was a glimmer in his eyes that Frankie assumed had seduced plenty of women. She did not intend to fall prey. But the truth was that he tempted her. And she was pretty sure he knew it. On the day of her first shift in the OR, Frankie paused at the stacked sandbags outside the door, took a deep breath, and walked into the Quonset hut. Chaos. Bright lights, music blaring, doctors and medics and nurses shouting instructions, casualties screaming. She saw Jamie, dressed in a bloody gown and masked up, coming toward her. There was blood everywhere, on walls, the floor, faces, dripping, geysering, pooling. Patty Perkins, in bloody fatigues, yelled, "You're in the way, McGrath!" and pushed Frankie aside. She stumbled and hit the wall as two medics carried a litter into the OR. On it, a soldier, a kid, was sitting up, yelling, "Where are my legs?"
"Just breathe, McGrath,"
Jamie said, touching her shoulder gently with his gowned elbow. She looked up at him, saw his tired eyes above his mask. A gurney wheeled past them, a young man with his guts hanging out. Barb was running alongside the gurney.
"Coming in from pre-op!"
Frankie stared at the trail of blood behind the gurney, feeling sickness rise into her throat.
"Okay, McGrath, you know what a DPC is, yes?"
Jamie said. She couldn't remember.
"McGrath, focus!"
She knew, of course she did. She'd been tending to them for weeks. "Delayed primary closure. Dirty wounds need to be cleaned. We close them later to prevent infection."
"Right, come with me."
Frankie moved through the OR, realizing halfway across that Jamie was close enough to keep her moving forward. He led her to a young man who lay on a gurney.
"This is a D&I. Debride and irrigate. That's a frag wound. We need to stop the bleeding and remove the metal fragments and cut away the dead skin. Then we irrigate with saline. We make little holes out of big ones. Can you help me?"
She shook her head. He stared down at her, said softly,
"Look at me."
She exhaled slowly and looked up at him.
"No fear, McGrath. You can do this."
No fear. "Right. Yes," she lied. "Yes, of course." For the next 6 hours, the doors to Ward 6 banged open repeatedly, with medics and corpsmen bringing in the wounded from pre-op. Frankie learned that it was called a push. Now she stood across an operating table from Jamie, both of them capped, gowned, and gloved. Between them lay a young sergeant whose chest had taken a close-range gunshot. To Frankie's right was the tray of surgical instruments and supplies.
"Hemostat,"
Jamie said. He gave Frankie a moment to study the tray of instruments, and then,
"It's next to the retractor. See it?"
Frankie nodded, picked up the forceps, and handed them to him. She watched, mesmerized, as he repaired the wound, stitched a vein deep inside the man's chest.
"Allen clamp."
He took the clamp she handed him and went back to work. By 2200 hours, Frankie was dead on her feet and covered in blood.
"All done,"
Jamie said at last, stepping back.
"Last patient,"
Barb said, cranking up the radio on a Van Morrison song. Singing along, she crossed the OR and approached Frankie and Jamie.
"How did my girl do?" Barb asked Jamie.
Jamie looked at Frankie.
"She was great."
"I told you you could cut it,"
Barb said to Frankie, giving her a hip bump. Patty skidded into place beside Barb.
Good job, Frankie. You'll be a star in no time.
She slung an arm around Barb.
O Club?
Barb pulled down her mask.
You got it. See you there, Frankie.
Frankie was so tired she could barely nod. Barb and Patty put arms around each other's shoulders, kept each other standing as they headed for the doors. Jamie pulled off his surgical cap and called for a medic to take the patient to post-op. When the gurney was wheeled away, Jamie and Frankie were left alone in the OR, facing each other.
Well, he said, giving her a steady look. She knew somehow that it mattered to him how she felt about tonight.
I have a long way to go, she said.
Then she smiled at him.
But, yeah.
There are men going home to their families because of us. That's about all we can hope for.
He moved closer.
Come on, I'll buy you a drink.
I don't really drink.
Then you can buy me one.
After they discarded their scrubs and caps and gloves, he took her hand and led her out of the OR. She found herself leaning into him as they walked. She'd never had a serious boyfriend, never made love. Back in the world, it had seemed important to be a good girl, to make her parents proud. But honestly, the horror she saw here every day made the rules of polite society seem unimportant. Not surprisingly, the O Club was packed with people, all of whom looked exhausted and beaten up after tonight's push. But they were done now and needed to unwind. Ethel was seated at a table alone, smoking a cigarette. Barb was on the makeshift dance floor in some man's arms, barely moving to the music. It looked more like they were holding each other upright than dancing. Some guy in the corner was strumming a ukulele. Jamie led Frankie to Ethel's table and pulled out a chair for her. Frankie practically fell into it. Then he headed to the bar for drinks.
Well?
Ethel asked, offering Frankie a cigarette. Frankie took it, lit it off of Ethel's.
I didn't kill anyone. Hell, Frank, that's a great first day in the OR.
She sighed.
Triage was brutal. Charlie really tore the shit out of those boys. Every single expectant died.
Ethel held Frankie's hand for a moment, both giving and receiving comfort. Then she stood up.
I can't stand it in here tonight. I'm going to the hooch for quiet. Maybe write my dad a letter. You?
Frankie glanced at Jamie, who was headed back from the bar.
Jamie's married.
Frankie looked up at Ethel.
Married? What? He never said...
Ethel touched her shoulder.
Be careful, Frank. Not everything the world teaches women is a lie. You don't want to get a reputation over here. I know I'm a good Baptist girl and far from cool, but some things are simply true no matter how much the world changes. Think carefully who you climb into a cot with.
Frankie watched Ethel walk out of the O Club. Moments later, Jamie sat down beside Frankie, scooted in close, offered her a Fresca.
I got you this, but I seriously recommend the whiskey.
Do you?
She sipped the lukewarm soda.
There's a hotel in Saigon, he said. The Caravel. It has a great rooftop bar. You'd love it. Soft beds, clean sheets.
Frankie turned to him.
You should wear a ring, you know.
His smile faded.
McGrath,
when were you going to tell me?
I figured you knew. Everyone knows.
What's your wife's name?
He sighed.
Sarah.
Do you have children?
One,
he said after a pause.
Davy.
Frankie closed her eyes for a moment, then opened them.
Do you have a picture?
He took out his wallet, pulled out a photograph of a tall, slender woman with bouffant hair, holding a tow-headed boy with plump cheeks and marshmallow arms and legs. He put the photograph away. There was a silence between them now, a quiet steeped in Frankie's disappointment.
It doesn't have to have anything to do with this. Us. Here.
You disappoint me,
she said.
Don't tell me lies, Jamie. Respect me, please. I believe in old-fashioned things, like love and honesty, and vows.
She downed her soda so fast it burned her throat. Then she stood up.
Good night.
Don't run off, McGrath. I'll be a gentleman, scout's honor.
I believe we've already determined that you were never a scout.
Yeah, he said. But I could use a friend tonight.
She knew how that felt. She wondered if it had been the photograph of his child that stole his smile and made him sad. Slowly, she sat down beside him. The truth was, she liked him. Too much, maybe, and she needed a friend tonight as much as he did.
How long have you been married?
4 years.
He looked down at his drink.
But
what? She asked, knowing it was a dangerous question. They were a long way from home here, in a world that felt impossibly fragile, lonely.
Sarah got pregnant the first time we had sex, at a dorm party in her senior year. I was in med school. It never occurred to either one of us not to get married.
And?
I'm a good guy, McGrath.
She stared at him, feeling strangely bereft, as if a chance had been lost before she'd even known of its existence.
And I'm a good girl.
I know that.
Between them, a silence fell. Then Frankie forced a smile.
Sarah must be a saint to put up with your sorry ass.
That she is, McGrath,
he said, looking at her sadly.
That she is.
May 16th, 1967. Dear Mom and Dad, I am training to be a surgical nurse now. I want to be good at this more than I've ever wanted anything. It's a good feeling to love what you do. The countryside is beautiful here, a kind of green I've never seen before, and the water is a stunning turquoise. We are in the monsoon season now, but so far that just means flashes of hard rain that come and go, leaving sunshine behind. No wonder everything is so green. I'm taking lots of pictures and can't wait to share this all with you. Then you'll understand. How's life back in the world? Love you, F. P.S. Please send hand lotion and cream rinse and perfume and a new St. Christopher medal. May 31st, 1967. Dear Frances Grace, I think about you all the time. I light a candle for you every Sunday, and I know your father sometimes sits in your bug with his hands on the steering wheel, staring at the garage wall. What he is thinking, I can only guess. It is a strange world we are all in, volatile and uncertain. We, Americans, I mean, can't seem to talk to each other anymore. Our disagreements seem insurmountable. I imagine it would feel wonderful to be good at something that mattered. That is something that too many of the women of my generation didn't consider. With love, your mother. 9. Frankie had stopped being afraid every time she walked into the OR. She was still often uncertain, but, like the turtle they'd called her on her first night, she'd developed a hard shell to protect her heart from what she saw, and the confidence to move past her own fear in order to help the men and women and children who ended up in the OR. It was the only way to survive. Patty, in her last weeks at the 36th, made it her mission to give Frankie every skill she'd learned during her tour. And of course, Barb was always ready to lend a hand in the OR, regardless of how little sleep she'd had the night before. And Ethel was there for emotional support. Now, on a hot, rainy June day, as she assisted Jamie in surgery, she heard the whirring of choppers overhead. More than one. It didn't even surprise her anymore, the escalating number of wounded coming through the OR, the growing number of pushes. The U.S. and ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, had pushed into the demilitarized zone that separated the Communist North from the American-aided South, and the fighting was brutal. She wished Patty were still here, but she'd gone home last week with a hell of a send-off.
Shit,
Jamie said through his mask. He was elbow deep in the kid's abdomen.
His spleen's ruptured.
Frankie picked up a clamp and handed it to him. Moments later, the OR doors banged open. Barb, masked and gowned, wheeled in another casualty from pre-op.
Doc, sucking chest wound. It's bad.
Jamie cursed under his breath.
I'll get to it. We gotta get this spleen out.
He reached out, took instruments from Frankie, and handed them back, working quickly. Sweat appeared on his brow. Droplets slid down to his mask. Finally, he stepped away from the table.
That's it. You're on your own now, McGrath.
Me?
Jamie took off his gloves and reached for a new pair. As he started on the chest wound, he said,
You can close, McGrath. You've watched me do it enough. Just take nice, wide bites of fascia, put in all of the stitches, tag them, and tie the sutures with 5 square knots. Count 'em. 5.
She shook her head. I can't.
Damn it, McGrath. We don't have time for fear. You're good enough. Do it.
Frankie nodded, swallowed hard, moving in closer to the patient's draped, sliced-open abdomen.
It's just like sewing, McGrath. Don't all you nice sorority girls know how to sew? You can stitch.
Frankie took a deep breath and released it. You can do this. She took another moment to focus, to tune out the noise and mayhem, the sound of the rain hitting the roof. When she'd calmed, she gently began to close the kid's fascia, one stitch at a time. She counted each knot, kept careful track of them.
Good, Jamie said, glancing over at her. I knew you could do it.
Frankie had never focused on anything so intently in her life. The din in the OR faded away. She felt her own heartbeat, the flicker of her pulse, the air moving through her lungs. The whole world compressed into the bloody space in this kid's belly. By the time she'd closed the fascia, she was sweating profusely, but she kept working. Finally, she let out a long breath and closed the wound and stared down at her work. The sutures were perfect. She had never felt so proud. This, she thought. This is who I came here to be.
I'm done here, Jamie said to Frankie.
Me too, she said.
They both looked up at the same time. Even though he was masked, she could tell that he was smiling.
Told you, McGrath.
She could only nod.
Now move, he said. I just heard another dust off land.
In late June, monsoon season hit with a vengeance. The weather was like nothing Frankie had ever seen. Howling winds ripped off roofs, tore away signs. Rain fell in sheets, blown sideways by the wind. The red dirt turned to a viscous, clinging mud that oozed into the OR from outside, mingling with blood on the concrete floor. It was a constant job to shovel it away. Frankie and the other nurses and the medics and anyone else they could wrangle into picking up a shovel spent time trying to push the mud outside. And it was cold. Frankie stared down at the patient in front of her, his guts split wide open, his chest covered in frag wounds. Tonight's storm battered the Quonset like a kid continuously hitting a toy barn with a hammer.
He's gone,
Jamie said, then cursed under his breath. She looked at the clock for time of death, reported it in a quiet voice. She had been on her feet for 12 hours. Monsoon season made every part of life more difficult. Or maybe it wasn't the weather that was bad. Maybe it was the increased number of wounded that came through these doors. Last week had been mostly quiet, with lots of downtime for the nurses. Not so this week. LBJ kept sending more and more troops into the fray, hoping manpower would turn the tide, while the Stars and Stripes published "Rah, rah, America is winning the war" articles every week. She shivered hard, her stained, faded fatigues damp beneath her surgical gown. Her pockets bulged with cigarettes and lighters. She always kept them on hand to give to her boys. That was how she thought of the casualties now, as her boys. In her breast pocket, she had a small flashlight and bandage scissors. A length of stretchy rubber tubing hung limply from one epaulet, just in case she needed to draw blood on the fly. A Kelly clamp hung from one belt loop. A blue surgical cap covered her shaggy hair, and a mask covered her nose and mouth. All anyone could see of her was her tired eyes. Jamie looked at her over the dead body of a kid who had probably been playing high school football 6 months ago.
You okay, McGrath?
Fine. You?
He nodded, but she saw the truth in his eyes. He was as exhausted and dispirited as she was. They knew each other so well now. In the past month, they'd spent more hours together than some married couples spent together in a year. All of this hardship, the rain, the damp, the cold, the mud, the wounds, the hours spent trying to save men's lives, had bound them together, made them into more than friends. Sometimes, over here, the only way to handle the emotional pain was to laugh or cry. Frankie rarely cried anymore, but when she did, she was probably in Jamie's arms. He was always there for her, and she was there for him. He could make her laugh in the harshest of moments. They stood together for hours, she and Jamie, working in tandem. She knew every nuance of emotion on his face, the way he gritted his teeth in anger when he saw a child burned beyond recognition by napalm, or a soldier who worried about his friends even as he was bleeding out. She knew he missed his beloved Wyoming ranch with its cool nights and hot days and its horses in the barn and a field full of flowers just beyond his front porch. He missed fly fishing and horseback riding and floating down the Snake River on an inner tube, a six-pack of beer floating with him. She knew that Sarah was a kindergarten teacher who sent him baked goods every week and worried that he didn't write back often enough and repeatedly asked if he was okay, and that he couldn't write anything in answer to that question except, yes. She fought her feelings for him. But at night, alone in her cot, she thought of him. Thought, what if? It might all be a mirage, this connection between them, brought on by proximity and the horror of what they saw every day. But it felt real. He touched her whenever he could, as casually as possible, and with a forced smile. Sometimes they found themselves standing together, or sitting side by side, just staring at each other, saying nothing, both of them feeling too much for the other, and knowing that words wouldn't ease their longing. She peeled her gloves off and lowered her mask. Both of them had red mud in the corners of their eyes, dripping down in tears and in their teeth.
What a day.
I need a drink. Maybe 10. Join me?
Tonight, her longing for him was too sharp to hide. She needed to be away from him.
I am too tired for the O Club, she said.
Is that possible?
He said. Frankie meant to smile.
Tonight it is.
They pulled off their gowns and caps and put on their army-issued green ponchos and walked out of the OR and into a raging rainstorm.
Just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, Jamie said.
Rain clattered on the walkway's roof and fell in sheets on either side of them, riveting the thick red mud. They walked past the mess hall, and Frankie realized with a shock that it was lunchtime. Time lost all meaning during a mass cal, and when they were understaffed, as they were now, shifts seemed to go on forever. She hadn't eaten since... when? Dinner last night? Her stomach grumbled. She didn't signal her intention, just stumbled sideways, bumping into Jamie, pushing him aside without meaning to. Bypassing the urn of hot coffee, shower was all she could think, she grabbed two donuts and stumbled back out of the mess, where Jamie stood waiting for her.
Glazed,
she said, handing him one.
My favorite.
I know.
They crossed behind the stage, where a sign, Martha Ray coming next week, had been torn down by the wind and lay twisted and ruined in the mud. Frankie tucked her donut inside her poncho to protect it. Jamie stopped in front of the sandbagged entrance to the O Club. Wind shoved the beads sideways, made them clatter against the wall. She smelled cigarette smoke. Music rose above the din, happy together by the turtles. Imagine me and you. I do,
you know,
he said.
Do what?
Imagine me and you. I dream of you, McGrath.
Frankie's breath caught. Just now, as exhausted as she was, the will it took to pretend to feel only friendship for him was hard to summon. She couldn't smile. All she could think of was that she loved him. God help her.
Jamie, don't.
If only I'd met you first, he said.
You wouldn't have looked twice at me. Big college football star and soon-to-be surgeon.
He touched her cheek in a swift caress. Her skin felt colder without his touch.
You have no idea how beautiful you are, McGrath.
Frankie was afraid that in one more second of standing here looking at him in this secret world where rain fell all around them, she would lose this battle. If one leaned forward, the other might too. She had never wanted to kiss a man more. The love she felt for him caused a physical ache in her chest. She had to force herself to step back. She wanted to say something clever, but nothing came to her. Flipping up her hood, she angled forward to keep the rain from sluicing down her back and ran for the nurse's showers. They were empty, probably because of the storm. Rain battered the elevated 400-gallon water trailer, called a water buffalo, that fed the showers. Frankie stripped and hung up her fatigues and poncho. In the cold air, the shower water felt warm. She didn't need to look down to see red water coming off. Red blood, red mud, red sweat. Geckos climbed the wooden walls of the shower, hid behind the crossbeams. She washed her hair and body. Without even bothering to dry off, she stepped back into her damp, dirty clothes and boots, flung the slick, wet poncho back over her body, and ducked back into the rain. At the plank bridge that ran over a gushing river of mud and water, she paused, slowed enough to check her balance so she didn't fall into the coiled concertina wire on either side, and then she was back under the covered walkway. The hooch was rattled by the rain. Water sluiced down the wooden sides, created an ankle-deep puddle of red mud outside the door. She opened it slowly, stepped inside, bringing the mud and rain with her. There was no way to avoid it. In this season of wind and rain, the hooch always smelled of mildew and mold, and the floor was always muddy. On the small dresser by her bed, Frankie saw a brown, paper-wrapped, multi-stamped box beneath a blue airmail letter. Mail. She hung up her wet poncho, made herself a cup of coffee, peeled out of her damp fatigues, and stored her boots in her footlocker. Dry boots made a world of difference over here. She put on the pajamas her mother had sent her last week, dabbed some perfume on her throat, and climbed into bed. She opened the box, saw a bag of homemade cookies, a box of See's chocolates, and some Twinkies inside, and smiled. When she tore open the envelope, a newspaper clipping fell out. In it, a crowd of protesters were burning the American flag. July 5th, 1967. Dearest Frances Grace, I only want to write with good news, but the world has gone insane. The hippies aren't so peaceful anymore, I can tell you. Thousands of war protesters, boys burning their draft cards and women burning their bras. Race riots. Good Lord. Our annual party was a rather diminished affair, I must say. All anyone talks about is the war. You remember Donna Van Dorn from Sunday school? At Bridge Club last week, I heard that she started dropping the acid and left college to join a folk band. Supposedly, she is living in some commune and making candles. For goodness sake, she's a DAR member and a sorority girl. People at the club are starting to wonder if the war in Vietnam is wrong. Apparently, some international war crimes tribunal found the U.S. guilty of bombing civilian targets, including schools. Schools, Frankie! And churches! And even a leper colony! Who knew there were even lepers left in the world? Stay safe, Frances, and write soon. I miss you. Love, your mother. Frankie found an almost dry sheet of thin blue airmail stationery so she could write back. In this humidity, the ink smeared through to the other side. July 18th, 1967. Dear Mom, thank you so much for the treats. I can't tell you how much they lift everyone's spirits in this terrible monsoon season. The weather is tough to describe and tougher to endure. The only thing worse than the rain is that my friend Ethel's D-Rose came in. That's army speak for the date eligible to return overseas. In other words, her date for going home. You remember me telling you about Ethel, the one who plays the violin and wants to be a big animal veterinarian? Anyway, in September, she'll be leaving Vietnam, going home. I can't imagine doing this without her. But I will, I guess. Over here. Frankie heard the sound of incoming choppers and put down her pen. Sighing, she stowed the unfinished letter and most of the treats in her makeshift nightstand and dressed in her still-damp fatigues and put her boots back on. Her shift was over, but what did that matter, as understaffed as they were? There were wounded incoming, and nurses would be needed. Slipping the still-wet poncho over her clothes, she headed for the OR and saw a pair of ambulances drive up to the pre-op door, just off the helipad. Jamie was already in the OR, in his surgical cap and gown.
No rest for the wicked, eh, McGrath?
She handed him a Twinkie. None at all. In late July, on a day with no incoming casualties expected, Barb organized a medcap trip, and the three nurses and Jamie headed for the helipad, where a stripped-down Huey waited for them. Today, they were catching a ride to St. Elizabeth's Orphanage, which was housed in an old stone church not far away. Holding her olive-green boonie hat on her head, Frankie angled forward and ran for the helicopter and jumped aboard. For the first time, she didn't move to the back. She didn't want to be afraid anymore, didn't want to think of Finley every time she climbed into a helicopter. Instead, she sat carefully on the floor near one of the gunners, whose machine gun pointed down at the land below. She cautiously swung one leg over the edge, then the other. Barb sat in the other open door. Ethel and Jamie sat in the back. When the chopper lifted, Frankie's breath caught. And then they were up, flying over the countryside. Frankie had never felt so free, so fearless. Wind whipped across her face. The green landscape below was stunningly beautiful. She saw the thread of sand along the turquoise South China Sea. The helicopter banked hard, turned inland, and swooped low over some rice paddies. Frankie saw a red dirt road that sliced through a dense swath of elephant grass. There, the chopper paused, hovered, the rotors thwopping loudly, the grass flattened by the wash. Slowly, the bird lowered to the ground and touched down just long enough to let the medcap team get out and then flew away, headed north. As the medical team approached the orphanage, the doors banged open, and children in ragged clothing surged forward, waving their hands, jostling each other in excitement. They knew the Americans brought candy to hand out to the children. Behind them, Vietnamese nuns dressed in black habits, wearing conical straw hats, looked on wearily. The nurses were swarmed by a group of young girls, all reaching out, wanting to touch them. Beside Frankie, Barb dropped to her knees, let the children touch her hair as she handed out suckers. Then she lined the kids up for vaccinations. For the next 4 hours, the nurses administered vaccines and gave out vitamins, tended to rat bites and treated malaria. Jamie stitched up wounds and even pulled a few rotten teeth. They were packing up to go when a petite, pretty, young Vietnamese nun came forward. She walked up to Frankie, looking hesitant.
Madame?
She said in French-accented English.
Yes,
Frankie said, wiping the sweat from her brow, resettling the bag of her medical supplies over her shoulder.
You could please follow me?
Frankie followed the nun into the cool interior of the orphanage. Each room had been turned into a dormitory, with straw mats on the floor for sleeping. One room held a dozen or more cribs, where babies slept and cried. It broke Frankie's heart to think of how many orphans were being made by this war. Who would care for these children and babies when it ended? At last, they turned a corner and stepped into an oblong room. Burned-down candles sat on windowsills and along the floor. So, no electricity. There was only one child in here, a a toddler, a girl, on a mat with her knees tucked up to her chest and her arms wrapped around her bent legs. She seemed to be making herself as small as physically possible. Frankie looked questioningly at the nun.
"A heat in her forehead,"
the nun said, touching her own forehead to communicate clearly. Frankie knelt on the hard stone floor beside the mat. Up close, she could see that the girl was a little older than she'd thought, but her body had been pared down by malnutrition.
"She will not eat," the nun said. "Hey, little one," Frankie said, stroking the girl's messy black hair.
The girl didn't move or respond, just gazed at Frankie through sad brown eyes. Her snarled hair obscured an ugly burn that puckered the skin along her jaw.
"What's your name?"
Frankie asked, touching the child's forehead, studying the burn, which didn't look to be infected. Fever, but not a bad one.
"We do not know her name,"
the nun said quietly, kneeling down to stroke the girl's back.
"Her village was bombed. She was found by one of your medics, hiding in a ditch."
She paused.
"In her dead mother's arms."
Frankie felt a heaviness in her heart, a sorrow that she knew would stay with her. There was no defense against a thing like this. No matter how hard a shell she'd built up to protect herself, some pains couldn't be forgotten. This girl would be one of them, one of the faces she would see in her sleep, or on the nights she couldn't sleep.
"We are calling her Mai. We do not know if she understands us. Some of them are too broken."
Frankie wanted to take the child in her arms and tell her that it would be all right. But would it be all right for a girl like this? Frankie dug in her bag for some baby aspirin and antibiotics. "These should control her fever, and I'll give you an ointment for her burn. It will help with scarring." Then Frankie reached back into her medical bag and pulled out a cherry sucker, which she offered to the girl. The girl just stared at it. Frankie unwrapped the sucker, licked it, and smiled, then offered it again. The girl reached out slowly, took hold of the slim white stick. Staring at Frankie, she brought the sucker to her mouth, licked it, and licked it again, and again. Frankie waited for a smile that never appeared. She wished she were surprised, but she understood this child's trauma all too well. More and more villages were being burned or bombed. More Vietnamese were dying, leaving their children alone in the world. The tragedy of it all was overwhelming. She started to get to her feet. The girl reached out, touched her ankle. Frankie sat back down. Tears glistened in the girl's eyes. Frankie took the child in her arms, rocked her gently, hummed "Puff the Magic Dragon" until the girl fell asleep. Frankie stared down at the wounded child in her arms, this girl who was too small for her age and scarred for life and probably all alone in the world, and her heart ached for Mai and the children like her, devastated by this war. She stroked the girl's hot forehead and kept singing, holding back tears one breath at a time.
"McGrath, the chopper's on its way back. We need to go."
Frankie turned, saw Jamie standing in the doorway. She put the sleeping child on her mat and leaned down to kiss her scarred cheek.
"Sleep well, Mai,"
she said in a taut voice. Her balance felt off as she stood up. Her feet were tingling. Jamie was there instantly, holding her steady. She reached for his hand, held it, not daring to look at him.
"Frankie?"
She couldn't help herself. She turned to him, and he took her in his arms and held her. She felt the tears gather in her eyes, burn and fall. They were lost in the cotton field of his t-shirt. He didn't say anything, just held her until she was strong enough to pull away.
"Thanks,"
she said at last, not looking at him, wiping away her tears.
"She'll remember your kindness," he said. "That little girl, probably for all of her life. And she will run and play and grow up."
The words meant so much to Frankie that she could only nod. How had he known exactly what she needed to hear? They walked out into the sunshine. In the ratty yard, the children were playing with a ball the team had brought them, were kicking it back and forth and laughing. Not far away, the helicopter landed on the dirt road, its rotors flattening the elephant grass and stirring up the red dirt. The medical team ran for the chopper and jumped aboard. Frankie sat in the open door, her legs hanging over the side. Every now and then, she pulled her Polaroid camera out of her bag and snapped a picture and pulled the ghostly print from the camera, waving it to dry until the image appeared. But her heart wasn't really in it. In the distance, another helicopter flew low over the jungle, spraying herbicide. They landed back at the 36th with ease, where it was quiet. Amazingly, there were no people running from the ER to pre-op to the OR, no patients in triage, no ambulances rumbling into the compound, no rain falling in sheets, no lakes of mud to wade through. She and Ethel and Barb and Jamie walked to the mess hall, where the women grabbed some sandwiches and tabs, and Jamie got a beer. On the beach, a dozen shirtless men played volleyball. Music blared out from a set of speakers, and the sound of hammering rang out. More buildings being erected. In the distant hills, mortar rounds exploded, made a sound like popping corn. Jamie wrenched off his shirt and kicked off his shoes and joined the men at the volleyball net. The women dragged three beach chairs out onto the sand and sat there, eating their sandwiches, staring at the white sand and blue water, and at the bare-chested men. Tonight, a movie screen would be set up out here. Rumor was that someone had gotten a print of The Great Escape. Behind them, someone cranked up the music as loud as it would go. Leaving on a jet plane got people singing along. A pair of female Red Cross volunteers, called Donut Dollies, dressed in their skirted uniforms, pushed a cart full of drinks and cookies out to the beach. Their nickname might sound soft, but those girls were tough as nails. They traveled all over Vietnam by whatever transport was necessary to boost morale among the troops. "What's wrong?" Barb asked Frankie. Frankie wasn't surprised by the question. They were more than best friends, she and Barb and Ethel. The radical, the farm girl, and the good girl. Back in the world, they might never have met each other, might never have become friends. But this war had made them sisters.
"There was this little girl at the orphanage," Frankie said. "She'd been burned. Our medics found her by the side of the road, in her dead mother's arms."
Ethel gave a tired sigh. Frankie couldn't stop thinking about Mai, lying in a ditch, burned, still held in her dead mother's arms. Her village had been bombed. War was one thing. Bombing villages full of women and children was something else. God knew there were no stories about it in the Stars and Stripes. Why weren't they reporting that truth? A silence fell between them. In it lay the ugly truth that none of them wanted to face. The village was in South Vietnam, and only the Americans had bombs. 10. August passed in a series of hot, rain-drenched days. Sometimes the air was so humid it was hard to breathe. Everything Frankie put on and took off in this monsoon season smelled like mildew and was splattered with mud. There was no way to fully clean or dry clothes. Like everyone in camp, Frankie had learned not to care. In September, the rain finally stopped, and a soul-sucking heat took its place. At the end of every shift, when she took off her mask and surgical cap, they were soaked through with sweat. The Quonset huts and hooches became oven-like. After some relaxation at the O Club, or a movie under the stars on the beach, or maybe a game of gin rummy with Ethel and Barb, she collapsed onto her cot, praying for sleep.
"Wake up, Frank!"
"No."
Frankie rolled over on her cot, taking her damp sheet with her. A sharp jab in her shoulder came next.
"Wake up! It's 1300 hours.
Frankie groaned and rolled over. Her eyes opened slowly, painfully. Last night's mortar attack had gone on for hours. The explosions had rattled the hooches so hard that drops of red mud splattered down from the flat ceiling and landed in blotches on Frankie's cheeks. Frankie threw an arm over her eyes.
Go away, Ethel. We only went to bed an hour ago.
Two, actually, Barb said. Think for a moment about what day it is. Frankie pushed herself to a half-sit, anchored up on her elbows. She saw the calendar tacked up on the wall above Ethel's bed, with all the days X'd off.
Ethel's Deros.
That's right, sports fans, Ethel said, pulling the pink curlers out of her hair. Nam is losing the best nurse ever to serve in this man's army. I'm going back to the world, and I am not leaving this hellhole after two tours of duty with a pizza party at the O Club. Get your swimsuit on, Sleeping Beauty. I have a bird waiting for us.
Swimsuit? Frankie could hardly believe it. Yesterday, they'd worked for 14 straight hours, on their feet for all of it. She'd spent most of those hours in surgery. Her back and knees hurt. And now, she glanced at her wristwatch. They were going to go swimming at some officers' club at 1,300 hours on their only day off in 2 weeks? Ethel yanked the covers back, revealing Frankie in her t-shirt and panties. She wore socks to bed, even in this heat, to save her toes from bugs and other creepy crawlers. Truth be told, it was why she wore panties, too. Frankie climbed out of bed. It took effort. Her legs felt like jelly, and her feet felt as if wild dogs had chewed on them while she slept. She put on her two-piece, belted red swimsuit, stepped into her sneakers, and headed to the latrines. The smell hit her halfway there. Human shit and smoke. Some poor FNG was on shit duty. Literally. His job was to empty the latrines and burn the waste in 55-gallon metal barrels. She followed the plank walkway to the showers. This time of day, the water was almost warm, heated as it was by the sun. Still, she showered quickly and towel-dried her body. Not that she needed to in this heat.
Finally, Ethel said when Frankie strolled back into the hooch. A damn debutante takes less time to get ready.
What do you know about Debs? Frankie said, buttoning her cutoffs and bending over to lace up her sneakers. Then she grabbed a pair of scissors and hacked at the hair around her face. There was no mirror in the hooch, which Frankie figured was just as well. Barb covered her short afro with a bandana, tied it in the back, and then took the scissors from Frankie. Without a word, she took over cutting Frankie's hair. Frankie let her do it, completely trusting. Such was the nature of the friendships Frankie had formed over here. It wasn't hyperbole to say that she trusted Barb and Ethel with her life.
Come on, country club, Deb, Barb said to Frankie, tossing the scissors on the dresser. The boys'll be waiting.
Boys?
Frankie crammed some clothes into her pack, and the trio left the hooch. The 36th was surprisingly quiet today. Oh, there was mortaring going on, explosions in the jungle past the concertina wire, but no red alert siren yet. She could hear men shouting. They were playing football in the open space in front of the empty stage. At the helipad, an armed helicopter waited, one of the Seawolves' choppers. The nurses bent forward and ran toward it. The gunner reached out, helped them all aboard. At the last moment before takeoff, Jamie appeared, in gym shorts and a faded Warlocks t-shirt, and jumped into the chopper. The pilot gave them a thumbs up, and up they went, the rotors picking up speed. The thwop-thwop became a blur of sound. The bird's nose did a sharp dive, the tail lifted, and they sped forward, flying low. Gunners stood at fixed machine guns at the open doors. Frankie sat in a canvas seat in the back of the chopper, with Jamie beside her. Through the open doors, she saw the world flash by. White beaches, turquoise water, red dirt roads that cut like veins through it all as they sped south toward Saigon. As they neared the capital city, Frankie saw a verdant green landscape shot through with silver strands. The Mekong Delta appeared like a lace overlay. Far away, flashes of orange flared in the jungle, explosions in the bush. A few minutes later, the chopper touched down in a flat, treeless field. The pilot powered down, then took off his flight helmet and turned around.
Another perfect landing for the sea wolves. Ladies, please note it in your diaries.
Ethel laughed. Frankie, meet Slim. Smile, but don't believe a word he says. He thinks he's James Bond. That's what happens when a guy can fly jets and choppers. He thinks he's a god.
Slim was tall and lanky, with broad shoulders. A bushy mustache and ragged beard somehow enhanced the pretty boy face underneath, giving him a rakish look. He immediately put on a battered cowboy hat to go with his camo t-shirt and short swim trunks.
James Bond wishes he was me,
Slim said, touching up his non-regulation mustache. He was a good-looking man, beyond good-looking, actually, and he knew it.
Howdy, ma'am, he said to Frankie, who couldn't help smiling at his southern charm.
And Slim wishes he was me,
said the co-pilot, a thin, sinewy guy with red hair and a scraggly mustache. He grinned at Frankie and the other women, showing off a set of crooked teeth.
Call me Coyote, he said,
and let out a wolf howl to go along with his introduction. He helped the ladies out of the chopper and held on to Frankie's hand a moment longer than was necessary. She felt him staring at her as he said in a slow Texas drawl,
Ladies, welcome to Sea Wolves Summer Camp.
It was so ridiculous, so back home, that Frankie couldn't help laughing. In front of them, a wide brown river arced lazily past, lapping against a reedy, marshy shore. The skyscape of Saigon rose in the distance, across the opposite shore. A banged-up speedboat hugged the bank, empty but for a man with a machine gun, sitting in the back, eyeing every movement on land and water and in the air. The land between the helicopter and the river had been turned into Beach Party Central. A banner that read, We will miss you, Ethel, was strung between two bamboo poles. Beneath it, a stocky man in a Rolling Stones t-shirt stood at a barbecue, grilling burgers. A portable generator powered a stereo, and purple haze blared through the speakers, loud enough to drown out the distant whine of the war. At least 30 people were here. Nurses from the 36th and Long Bin and Vung Tau, medics and doctors and corpsmen. Frankie recognized several dust-off pilots, as well as several sea wolves, and more than a few of the donut dollies from the 36th. They all stopped what they were doing at Ethel's arrival and turned to face the nurse and began clapping and whooping.
Speech, speech,
someone cried out. Ethel grinned.
Nurses don't give speeches, she said. We party.
A roar of approval rose through the crowd. The music changed to Good Lovin' and several people started dancing. Ethel looked up at Slim.
Cool flying, cowboy.
He put an arm around her, drew her close. Frankie knew that Slim and Ethel had developed a solid friendship over here. They'd bonded over their shared love of southern barbecue and western dancing and horses.
My boys will miss you, Slim said.
I'm one of many, Slim. Barb and Frankie put me to shame.
He kissed her cheek.
Glad you're leaving this shithole. Pissed you're leaving us behind.
Ha! Like you sea wolves didn't claw all over each other to join the unit. You'd rather be here than on that farm you grew up on.
Some days,
he said.
Yeah, Ethel said. Ain't that the God's truth? Best of times, worst of times.
If you two get any more philosophical or mushy, I'm gonna puke right on your boots,
Barb said.
We didn't haul our asses here to watch you feel things. We're here to say bon voyage to the best damn nurse at the 36th. So, where's the booze?
Coyote ducked over to a pyramid of coolers and opened the top one, pulling out four cold beers and bringing them back. Frankie snapped the cap and took a hesitant sip. Almost before she'd swallowed, Ethel grabbed her hand and said,
Come on, California girl.
And dragged her across the party and onto the speedboat moored at the riverbank. How in the hell had they come up with a speedboat? A tall man with a shaggy mustache and a Rainier beer t-shirt stood at the wheel. He tipped his ratty straw cowboy hat at her.
Howdy, ma'am.
Coyote jumped on board, gave another howl, and put an arm around Frankie.
What do you say, Frankie McGrath? You game?
You know it.
She took a sip of the ice-cold beer. It tasted surprisingly good on this hot day.
How long had it been since she'd felt this free and young?
"We gotta take her,"
Coyote said, untying the mooring line.
"Take us out, renegade."
The guy at the controls grinned and hit the gas. Frankie stumbled into Ethel, who gave her a raised eyebrow.
"What is the most important rule in Nam, Frank?
Don't drink the water?"
"That's number one. Number two, never volunteer."
The boat sped through the water, a thrilling, heart-stopping ride. Suddenly, they slowed. The boat stopped in the middle of a wide expanse of the river and rolled from side to side. Coyote tented a hand over his eyes, his gaze scouring both shores.
"Don't see anything to worry about."
"What,
us worry?"
Renegade said. Leaning sideways, he pulled up a pair of old, battered wooden water skis. Frankie laughed. Then he produced a ratty flotation belt, upon which someone had written, "Keep it up, boys." He tossed the belt to Frankie. She stopped laughing.
"When I said I was game..."
"I knew you were my kind of girl."
Coyote lit a cigarette and gave her a wicked smile.
I've never skied before."
"You will dig it, trust me. Put on the belt."
Frankie glanced out at the river. She'd heard about bodies floating in this brown water, swollen from death and rigged with explosives. And this was the tropics. Were there poisonous snakes and alligators? What about the VC? Could Charlie be underwater with a plant on his head for camouflage, waiting for an American stupid enough to water ski in the Saigon River? Frankie took a deep breath and remembered Jamie's words. "No fear, McGrath." She exhaled and stripped down to her two-piece bathing suit and fastened the belt around her waist. "So," Ethel said, touching her shoulder, "I started water skiing when I was a kid at Bible camp. A fun life story for another time. Anyway, hold on and lean back and keep the skis perpendicular to the boat. Let us pull you up, just like getting out of a chair. The rope goes between the skis. When you fall, let go immediately."
"In case I die, I'll say goodbye now."
Ethel laughed. "Goodbye, Frank. It's been great knowing you." Frankie slipped over the side of the boat into the brown, murky river water. Clutching the skis in one hand, she swam out behind the boat and spent more than 5 minutes trying to put her bare feet into the rubber bindings. At least 3 times she got the skis on and immediately flipped onto her face and had to fight to right herself, all the while keeping her mouth clamped shut. The idea of drinking this water scared her more than getting bit by a snake. Finally, she got herself into position. She sat back, put the rope between her skis, held onto the bar, and nodded. The boat started, dragged her. She fought to keep her skis steady. They hit the gas, sped up. Frankie got halfway up and face planted. The boat turned sharply, swung back around. Ethel threw her the rope.
"Let us drag you. We'll hit it when you look steady."
Frankie nodded, her mouth squeezed shut, trying not to think of the water getting into her eyes and nose. It took 4 more tries, and by then, Frankie was too tired to fight the rope or the speed. She just leaned back and held on and thought, "How many times do I have to try?" And then, quick as an indrawn breath, she was up, skiing behind the boat, struggling to keep her skis steady and her weight equally distributed. She saw the people on the boat clapping for her. She held herself in the calmer water between the white V of the wake, her skis thumping and falling on the water. Wind lifted her hair, and the hot sun shone down on her, and for a beautiful, heart-stopping moment, she was just a girl at a beach party with her friends. She thought of Finley teaching her to surf in the rolling waves. "Catching a wave, Finn. Look at me." She was overcome by a joy so strong and sweet and pure that there was only one thing to do. She let out a wolf howl. That evening, sunset turned the world purple and red. In the distance, across the ribbon of river, the lights of downtown Saigon shimmered. The group on the beach had faded along with the daylight, Stuffed with cheeseburgers and potato chips and American beer, half drunk, they sat around a roaring campfire. Frankie, pleasantly buzzed on three beers, leaned against Ethel. Holding hands seemed like the most natural thing in the world.
"Tell me about it again," she murmured.
"The grass is so green, it hurts your eyes," Ethel said.
"My grandfather found the land and saved every dollar he made blacksmithing to buy it. There's nothing I love better than riding on autumn roads at a full gallop. You'll come someday, you and Barb. We'll eat barbecue and ride horses and forget everything we saw over here."
Frankie loved Ethel's stories about Virginia, the county fairs, the 4-H competitions, the church socials. It sounded like a world that didn't exist anymore.
"I won't let you go back without me," Frankie said.
Before Ethel could answer, Jamie stumbled over and stood in front of Frankie. She was afraid to look up at him. She'd kept her distance all day because her defenses felt weakened by the beer she'd drunk and today's camaraderie and the strange sense that these were good days, maybe, impossibly, the best of their lives. Jamie was now officially a short-timer. His Deros had come in, and he had less than 3 months left on his tour. Like all short-timers, as his leave date neared, he'd begun to worry that nothing would work out for him, that Vietnam had somehow ruined him and he wouldn't get out alive. And every day, Frankie confronted the reality that he was one day closer to leaving.
"Dance with me,"
he said, holding out his hand. He wouldn't have done it sober, not here in front of everyone, on a night when the longing in his eyes was obvious, and she wouldn't have agreed on another night either. But just now, with three beers in her system and Ethel leaving, Frankie didn't have the strength to say no to him. She let him pull her to her feet. He led her away, took her in his arms. His hand slipped down her back, past the curve of her waist. She felt his fingers slip under the waistband of her baggy shorts. She reached back, moved his hand to the small of her back.
"Be a good scout."
"You want me, McGrath," he said. "And God knows I want you."
She looked up at him. "It doesn't matter what either one of us wants."
"Come to Maui for R&R with me tomorrow."
"Sarah would not appreciate that," Frankie said. She knew Jamie was meeting his wife for R&R.
"Once you see her, you'll forget all about me."
He leaned forward so slowly, she knew he expected her to stop him. But she couldn't. He kissed the side of her neck. She let it go on longer than was smart, and then pushed him away, immediately missing the feel of him.
"Don't, please."
"Why not?"
"You know why,"
she said in a quiet voice.
"Could you have loved me?"
he asked quietly. She wanted to say, "I already do," so badly it took every bit of willpower she possessed to smile. She touched his face, let her hand linger on his skin for a moment, letting it be the words she didn't dare say. Then she walked away from him while she still had the strength to do so and sat back down by Ethel.
"That man loves you," Ethel said quietly.
Her feelings for Jamie were not something Frankie could talk about, even with Ethel. She leaned against her friend.
"How can I do this without you?" "I love you too, Frank. And you're going to be okay without me."
Without me. Maybe it was the three beers she'd drunk, or the eerie falling darkness pocked by the sounds of a distant war, but a wave of homesickness assailed her. Made her think of Finley. No remains. She was tired of losing people.
"I must be cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs," Ethel said, certifiable, "because I don't want to leave."
"I'm crazy too, because I don't want to see you go."
The fire crackled and popped. Slim roasted a marshmallow over one of the licking red flames. The music had been turned down. Suddenly, the night erupted in noise and color. Red explosions, tracers through the dark sky, a machine gun's rat-a-tat-tat not far away. The gunner from the bird ran over.
Sorry, gang, Riot just called in. The Seawolves are needed at Rocket City. Party's over.
Frankie looked at Ethel. Rocket City?
Play Coup. It's up in the Highlands. Dangerous place.
The party dispersed. People ran for the chopper, for the boat, for the three jeeps hidden in the brush. Frankie and her friends boarded the helicopter, which lifted up into the air quickly. The land below was pocked by explosions. In the Huey, up in the air, bombs and rockets and gunfire burst all around them, bright orange stars in the dark. The smell of smoke. The chopper veered sharply, climbed fast.
They're shooting at us,
Slim yelled into the comm headset.
Damn rude on a beach day.
The bird veered so sharply that Frankie cried out. Jamie put an arm around her, held her close.
It's okay, McGrath,
he whispered into her ear.
I've got you.
Frankie let it be, just for a moment, then pulled away. The gunner shot back. Pop, pop, pop. Another sharp turn, an evasion. A fighter jet streaked past. Below, a piece of the jungle exploded in red flames. Frankie felt the heat of it on her face.
Pop, pop, pop!
The machine gun at the door rattled in response. Spent casings clattered to the floor. All it would take was one good hit, and the bird would go up in flames. She couldn't help but think of Finley. Was this what it had been like for him? It was over as quickly as it began. The helicopter swooped sideways, lowered over the smoldering canopy of the jungle, and dropped down onto the helipad at the 36th. At 0300 hours, a red alert siren blared through camp. Then came the sound of incoming choppers, a swarm of them. One dust-off after another landed in the pouring rain, full of wounded. Frankie and Barb and Ethel stumbled out of bed and ran to the helipad, helping to offload them. Frankie spent the next 8 hours at Jamie's side, going from one surgery to the next until she was so tired she could barely stand. At 1100 hours, when the last patient was rolled out of the OR, Frankie reached numbly for a mop and began cleaning the floor until Jamie stopped her.
We're done,
he said.
Someone else can mop up the blood. Let's go.
Nodding, she put on her green poncho, flipped up her hood, and followed Jamie out of the OR. The wooden walkway was underwater. Rain pounded the roof overhead. He put an arm around her, steadied her as they walked through the compound. At Jamie's quarters, he came to a stop. Frankie realized suddenly that she was too close to him, touching his body with her own as they stood beneath the overhang, barely out of the rain. A tiny drizzle of someone else's blood streaked down Jamie's neck. She reached up to wipe it away. Jamie almost smiled, but not quite.
You want to kiss me before I go,
he said.
I knew it.
Have fun in Maui,
she said, embarrassed by the jealousy she felt at the idea of him being with his wife.
Bring me back something fun.
There was more love in his eyes than should be there, and probably too much in hers.
I love you, McGrath. I know I'm not supposed to.
She longed to say it in return, but how could she? Words were creators of worlds. You had to be careful with them. He was going to meet his wife, see pictures of his son.
I'll miss you, she said instead.
He stepped back.
See you in a week.
As she watched him leave, the moment played over in her mind. I love you, McGrath. Maybe she should have said it too. But what good could come of her love for him? He wasn't hers to love. When she couldn't stand the regret anymore, she flipped her hood up and headed for her hooch. She opened the door and realized instantly what she'd forgotten during the push. Barb sat on Ethel's empty cot.
She's gone.
Frankie sat down beside Barb, not even bothering to pull off her wet poncho.
We didn't get to say goodbye.
She didn't want us to. Probably slipped out while we were looking the other way. Bitch.
It was the way of Vietnam. People came, they did their tour, and they left. The lucky ones, like Ethel, flew home in one piece. Some wanted parties for their send-off, and some wanted to slip away in silence. Some wanted both. Either way, you woke up one day and your friend was just gone. War was full of goodbyes, and most of them never really happened. You were always too early or too late. Like with Finley. She had said goodbye to her brother long after the words could have mattered to him. That was one thing this war had taught her. There was never enough time with the people who mattered. It rained for the next week. Not a drenching monsoon rain, just a thumping, ever-present drip, drip, drip that demoralized everyone. Even gatherings at the O Club had all but ended. No one felt like partying in this weather. Now, as midnight neared, Frankie stood in the OR, in mask and cap and gloves and gown, closing an incision. Not far away, the new doctor, Rob Aldine from Kentucky, was trying to save a young Vietnamese woman's leg. While Jamie was on R&R in Maui with his wife, they were down to two surgeons, and that wasn't enough to keep up with the casualties. To make matters worse, they hadn't replaced Ethel yet, so they were understaffed in nurses, too. Four patients lay on tables awaiting surgery, with more in triage and pre-op. A bright light shone down on the patch of brown-washed skin of the soldier who lay anesthetized before Frankie. After her last stitch, she dropped her bloody instruments on her tray and peeled off her gloves.
"I'll get Sammy to take you to post-op, Private Morrison," she said aloud, even though the patient couldn't hear her.
She heard the distant sound of a helicopter coming in. Dr. Rob looked up, his worried gaze meeting Frankie's. They were at their ragged end. Just one chopper.
"Thank God," Frankie said.
Rob went back to work. The OR doors banged open, and a gowned and masked Barb came in with a pair of medics carrying a bloody patient on a litter.
"We need a surgeon. And you, Frankie, stat."
Frankie could tell it was bad by the look in Barb's eyes. Frankie washed her hands and picked up a new pair of gloves, snapping them on. The soldier on the litter wore a blood-soaked t-shirt and fatigues that had been cut off at the thigh. He'd lost his left leg at the knee. A medic had field-wrapped the bloody stump, but that injury was nothing compared to his chest wound. A thick layer of black-red blood covered his face. She picked up his dog tags.
"Hey, Captain Callahan.
Jamie." She looked up at Barb, saw the grief in her friend's eyes.
"I'm sorry," Barb mouthed.
"His bird was shot down, ma'am," one of the medics said.
Frankie wiped the blood from Jamie's face and saw the grievous injury to his skull.
"Rob," she shouted. "Get over here, now!"
The doctor came over, looked down at Jamie, and then at Frankie.
"He won't make it, Frankie, you know that. And we have..."
"Save him, Doc. At least try."
She reached for Jamie's cold, limp hand, held it.
"Please. Please!"